This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk with John Kalis about his new book, Wild Edible Plants. John is the owner, operator, and instructor at Wild Foods Adventure Outdoor School. He has a doctorate in nutrition, a master's in education, and degrees in biology and zoology. Do you forage or harvest from nature? How did you get started? Call us at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org and join the conversation. Hello, John.
Hi, how you doing, Jill?
I'm doing really well. Thank you for being with us. You know, my dad liked to forage, and he just loved Yule Gibbons, and he would have loved your book. Now, how did you get started with foraging?
Well, as a kid, I was always interested in the outdoors, and Native peoples really fascinated me, the historical version of them, because remember, as a, you know, back in the 60s, you see things on television, that was about it. We didn't really have any exposure other than that, but what I did link to was this idea of living off of nature. And which we all do, but we're sort of alienated from it right now through supermarkets and things like that. But, you know, I was interested in, you know, wild, making shelters, making bows and arrows, you know, eating plants, hunting game, all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, as I got older and got into college, I realized that, you know, where's the real practical thing here? And I don't like killing animals that much. So that's an interesting concept, that much. Wow. first time I said that. In any event, I started focusing on food, because there's another aspect of that is that when we go to a museum and we see artifacts, almost all of those artifacts involve food gathering and food production. You know, the bows and arrows, that's to gather food, you know, mostly. The baskets, that's to gather food. You know, so there, in fact, I think a museum should, that deals with that topic should actually have a botanical garden that shows all the plants that they would eat back in those days. But in any event, I got really interested, more focused in that interest, and then started taking classes. In college, I would just pursue whatever I was interested in. I wasn't like pursuing a degree, even though I have many degrees now. Originally, I was just taking things I was interested in. And so, you know, after a while, I kept learning more avenues of wild foods, you know, like there's ethnobotanical knowledge. So there's cultural history, there's soil science. I mean, there's a million things, nutrition. There are many, many topics that fit into this, so my interests were very wide.
Well, I'm glad you did, because this book is wonderful, and I need to find volume one somewhere. And you're planning on doing volume three, too, aren't you?
Well, if I was going to live to be 300, I would. It's based on the concept of an encyclopedia, you know, where you go into depth on each individual topic, and then you have multiple volumes because, you know, the book can only be so heavy.
Right.
And so, I mean, this one's already heavy, just like volume one, they're about the same size.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just keep going and going if I was going to live forever, but I'll probably get volume three and maybe four if I'm, you know.
Well, whatever you can manage, I'm sure the people who do like to forage will really appreciate it, because it's very nice in that you're so detailed. There's so much information, and it really, I think this book is so important for people who don't want to get the wrong plant, right? That's a pretty common thing, isn't it?
Well, yeah. In fact, you know, most of the time, you know, you don't have to show a poisonous lookalike if you know the plant well enough in the first place. It's only people that have a real surface knowledge and access to information. Those are the people that get confused. In fact, I would say I don't know of any case ever of people being poisoned by plants that knew just a little bit about the plant. Usually people that get poisoned, you know, they'll see something that looks like wild carrot out there, and they go, oh, I think I've, you know, found wild carrot. And they're very excited and proud of themselves for being so brilliant. And then they pull up the root, and they smell it, and it smells good, and they taste it, it tastes good. They put it in the dinner, and then they all die. Because, you know, it's poison hemlock.
Yeah.
And you can tell the difference between poison hemlock and wild carrot if you just know a little bit. But, you know, these are people that don't know anything. Yeah. And so, you know, they recognize the carrot top from the supermarket. And that's where the similarity there. And that's mm-hmm. where the similarity ends.
Sure. And a lot of time, the thing that you find on the internet isn't necessarily right. So it's best to have an expert. We've had Sam Thayer on with us a number of times, and he's from Wisconsin.
Nice.
So, and I saw that you mentioned him in your book. But yeah, he's always a good resource too. Also lots
of
books.
Absolutely. So, he's great. Yeah. Great books.
Yeah, he really does. So why should people consider foraging over maybe going to the grocery store? It's a little more convenient.
Well, if you're just talking convenience, everything has its, perspective. So, for instance, artichokes are a little bit less convenient than apples, right? So if you just try to eat an artichoke like an apple, it's not going to work. You have to process that artichoke. If you're going to bake bread, you got to go through some work to bake the bread. Of course, you have a bread machine and all, you know.
Not as much fun.
It's simplified life. But, you know, there's also wild fast food. You know, if you know wild foods that are very common, and those are the ones I focus in on the book, the most common wild foods in North America, then there's a lot of wild fast foods. There's many times I'll be riding my bike or right in my car, and I'll see an open field, and there's a, you know, curly dock in perfect condition. You know, I'll stop the car, get out, you know, grab the greens, put them in the car, and then drive home. And I've got gobs of greens now that are super easy to use. So, you know, it depends. Knowledge is power here. You know, the more you know, the easier wild foods are. But there's other reasons besides convenience, and that's nutrition and health and longevity. So the main health reason to have a knowledge of wild foods is greater diversity in the diet. So when you go to the supermarket, many of the foods are the same species. So you got broccoli, cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts. These are all the same exact species that have been manipulated over time by farmers to come into these different shapes that we know in the supermarket. But virtually every wild food that you learn is a different species. And so great diversity brings great health. And that was the lesson of the Mediterranean diet.
True.
So that was the real lesson of it, which is lost in the food guides. You know, food guides are real basic, and they don't have much space, and they don't want to confuse people. So for both plants and animals, there was great diversity in that diet. So the average granny on the island of Crete, which is where the study was originally done, knew 110 wild foods.
Wow.
And they'd be gathering every day, and they'd be eating these, you know, multiple different species for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They did not have cereal for breakfast or pancakes for breakfast. They had regular food in their meals, lots of greens. And the animals that they ate were very diverse, not just a fish. Because, you know, on the food guide, they just show you a picture of a fish. Well, they probably ate 15 different species of fish. They ate cuttlefish. They ate squid, octopus, clams, mussels, you name it. Gobs and gobs of species. And all year long. And so that was really, that had a major impact on their health, so that, you know, when they were in their 90s, they were healthy and rigorous people, you know, not, you know, dying of different degenerative diseases.
So diversity is good for all kinds of things, including food.
Absolutely.
Okay. And it helps with the grocery bill too, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it's free.
You know, exactly.
I mean, there's a different story. You know, if you're into mushroom hunting, for instance, and you have to get in your car and go up into the mountains to find a particular mushroom, then that's more recreation than it is money saving, because, you know, you're using a lot of fuel, you're taking a lot of time, and it, you know, it's great recreation, but, you know, you're not saving money there. You're particularly with gas prices today.
Very true. And we've got a phone caller here who has something to add. It's Chris, and he's in Black Creek. Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys. Oh, I'm sure your guest knows about this. They're called May apples. They grow in big patches in the woods. They have like a wide stem that comes out with two big leaves on it, and a fruit grows right in the middle of the, shall I say, crotch of it. It turns green. It's smaller than a lemon, and then when it turns yellow, I eat them. So I'm worrying about the nutritional value. Secondly, hickory nuts and black walnuts, the wild ones. I picked some and I went to move my shop. 10 years later, I find these nicely dried black walnuts and hickory nuts. I broke them up. 10 years later, they were still good. And third of all, my an old-timer friend, he said, a mushroom is always good at least once.
Yeah, that's very true.
Well, I don't know. Some of them can be pretty rank even in the first time.
True.
So,
yeah.
It's a funny saying, but yeah, there's exceptions to them.
So, John, have you heard of May apples? Like, you're out in Oregon, so I'm not quite sure if you have them there or not.
No, we don't have them here. They do grow in the eastern United States, and they're marvelous if you can beat the squirrels to them. Because basically what happens is, you know, they go through their stages. They start out green and then they turn yellow and soft. And as soon as they're ripe, the local animals know it. And so you have, you know, unless you're in a well-traveled area or you know, it's in your own yard and the animals are afraid of you, they're going to eat the May apples before you can get to them.
And he was also talking about the nuts, too. Black walnuts. The squirrels get those and hide them, but sometimes we can take advantage of that, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nuts are a totally different story. Mm-hmm. Nuts happen so profusely that the animals cannot keep up with them. And so there we have better access to them. And they're not soft. So that also limits the number of animals that can, you know, get through the husk and then through the shell and into the nut meat.
I've lived with a lot of black walnuts, and I know how hard they can be. Do you have a trick for getting to the meat?
You know, hammer.
Okay.
You can also use a vise.
Yes.
You know, you can just put them in a vise and crank it until, you know, because they're super hard.
Yeah, oh, I've heard people running over them in the driveway with their car, all kinds of things.
I'm not sure that works so well.
I have no clue.
Yeah, I'm not sure that works so well, but, you know, who knows? I haven't really tried it because I don't want crushed nuts.
And
because, I mean, if you really are crushing them,
yeah,
then the nut meat gets crushed with the shell, and then it's a mess.
Very, very, you know, true.
I like my nut meat whole.
I don't blame you. We're talking with John Kalis. He is the author of Edible Wild Plants, Wild Foods for from Foraging to Feasting. Are you a forager? What are some of your favorite plants? Join the conversation. Call us at 800-642-1234. Our producer today is Claire Neipert, and our technical director is Trina LaSousa. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. After 11:45 today, we're going to talk to the author of a great little book on plant diseases, and each disease has a limerick to go with it. So that's something to look forward. Right now, we're talking about foraging. And if you have something to add to the conversation, give us a call, 800-642-1234. So, John, let's talk a little bit about the book itself and what people will find in it when they open it up.
Like I said, each of my books is like part of an encyclopedic set. So each one will be divided into three parts. The first part is understanding wild foods. So we go into general ideas about, you know, what do you really need to know to understand wild foods? And then the second section is about specific plants. that I cover, and I cover them in great detail, as you mentioned earlier. And so that's just about individual plants. And then the third part is the potential of wild foods. So there I talk about nutrition and how, you know, the impacts of wild foods on different possibilities, how to, you know, why it's good for the richest diet and that kind of stuff. But now if I go back to the plant section now, and this really is what makes my book different from any other books that are out there, I go into tremendous detail, and as an educator, I try to understand what is it that people need who have not been exposed to plants all their lives. Because like you said, I think your father foraged,
yes,
did you say?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, my grandfather foraged. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he came from Greece, actually. And so, you know, he knew all these plants. Unfortunately for me, he lived in another state. So I really didn't get to know that till, you know, he was too old and, you know, it didn't work out really. But, you need to know everything about that plant in order to get the most out of it. So you need to know, what does it look like at its different growth stages? What are the edible parts? What do they look like when they're at their prime? And that's like one of the biggest mistakes people make is they'll see a wild food, they'll identify a wild food, you know, oh, great, now I have something to eat. And then they grab it and eat it, and then they go, oh, God, why would I ever eat another thing again from the wild? Because they got the wrong part, they got the wrong stage of growth, wrong season, you know, and so the plant is not at its prime. And so actually having pictures of the plant at its prime when you would pick it is pretty essential. And if you've got, you know, if you're into wild foods and you've got a bunch of books on your bookshelf, and you, let's say you have a book that's 400 pages and then they cover 400 plants, well, they're not giving you enough information. They're not giving you enough photographs. You really need to know a lot of stuff. And if there's special processing techniques, if, you know, if you just sort of talk about those and don't really show what that is, if it's a unique processing technique, then you're not going to understand that either. So that's what, you know, I have full chapters on each plant, you know, from start to finish, from, you know, foraging again to feasting at the end, all the steps in between, so that you really know what you're doing.
And you threw in a couple of recipes too, which is really kind of nice. So people have a way to, where to start somewhere with their newfound food.
Yeah. And I try to be, use very simple recipes. First of all, because I'm not a chef, I don't know what I'm doing, right? No wild food guy, I mean, that I know of is really a chef. You know, we dabble in this stuff. We do what is good for us. So the best thing is to show recipes that just get you started. They're not intimidating at all. They're very simple. They're basic. And they get you through that wall of the difference between an interest and actually doing it.
Yes.
You know? So, but there are some times, like with marshmallows, where, you know, you really have to go into detail and the recipe is a little bit more complex, you know, because nobody's ever done it before. So you have to show it in much more detail. So, you know, to establish a baseline for everybody after that.
Well, even making regular marshmallows takes a lot of detail. So yeah, you're in good company there. And the marshmallow, that looks so wonderful. I think I really, really need to find one of those plants. I haven't seen one. So there's got to be some around here someplace. So
yeah, well, they're mostly in the eastern North America. But they are pretty much everywhere because people plant them. Like in my area, they're planted all over the place in herb gardens because they're used for a lot of medicinal purposes. And, you know, they're good, you know, for skin and a bunch of other things, you know, digestive throat stuff, soothing your throat. And so they're planted all over the place and they spread easily.
Oh,
I planted them in my yard. Because I wanted them nearby and I wanted to study them. I do this a lot with plants that I cover. I actually plant them so I can see them every day and know exactly what they're doing and what they react to and all that kind of stuff for my books. But, you know, it's spreading all over my garden and I love it. And, you know, and they're the kind of plant where it's easy to manage, even if they're spreading. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every time you pull one, you got more food. So they're not just used for marshmallow, you know, the confection.
Yeah.
There's food in there. There's vegetables in there as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk about Japanese knotweed in a bit, but let's go to the phones first. We've got a number of people that want to talk. Alan in Eau Claire, you are next. What's your question?
Yeah, I'm actually originally a New Englander, and I've moved to Wisconsin about 10 years ago, and I am trying to find fiddleheads. You know where I might be able to find some?
Well, first of all, let me clarify that any young leaf of a fern is called a fiddlehead. It's not, you know, so, and you really want to find specific species to eat because not all of them are edible or, you know, delicious. And so you really need to know what you're doing. So you have the two main ones that people mostly think about are ostrich fern and bracken fern. And ostrich fern is really the main edible that I would, you know, recommend people, learn that one first. And that's found in most of the northwest woods, and northeastern woods. I'm living in the West, so that's not northwest.
I believe we have them here too. So
yeah. So you have ostrich fern there. Mm-hmm. We have lady fern out here. That's our main edible fern. Bracken fern, however, has it's actually the best tasting fiddlehead. However, it's got a mixed reputation because the cultures that eat bracken fern fiddleheads have a lot of throat and, you know, esophageal cancer and stomach cancer. But those are people that eat it as a very regular part of their diet. And so if your family has any history of cancer, I would leave those alone. If nobody in your family ever gets cancer, then it's probably okay to eat the bracken fern fiddleheads. Because your body has defenses against cancer, basically. But if you get, if your family has a history of cancer, any kind of cancer, I would pretty much stay away from the bracken fern.
All right. Well, Alan, hopefully you can find those somewhere, and you can feel like you're back at home. Thanks for the call. Let's see. Louise in Hudson, you are up next. Hi, Louise.
Hi. So we have an invasive species, the garlic mustard plant, and I've been pulling it out, took a course from the Horticulture Society on identifying it and how to prevent it from spreading. But one of my neighbors is a gourmet cook, and she has made both a dip and a pasta sauce out of it, similar to using the leaves and the flowers like a basil plant, adding some olive oil, putting it in the blender, adding some nuts of some sort, a little bit of Parmesan. And if we could get more people to harvest the garlic mustard, it wouldn't spread. A single plant can have 10,000 seeds, and it will spread in a 10-foot radius around a single plant. And so this year I see where there are plots of it that have millions of small plants coming up. So I'd like to encourage people to pick the garlic mustard. And if you're just picking it to eradicate, leave the roots on a log or a rock so that the plant dries out. Otherwise, it will re-root itself. But I do have a question about the fiddleheads. Are cinnamon ferns edible as when they're in the fiddlehead stage?
I do not know that. I don't know cinnamon fern, so I can't give you any recommendation on that. But the recommendation I do give is, yes, eat garlic mustard. It's amazing. It's one of the most nutritious plants ever analyzed. So, yeah, go for it. Now, the key thing with that is eat it when it's young, early spring. It's the best tasting in the early spring, and then pull it up before it goes to flower, because that's when the seeds spread. And the particularly bad thing about garlic mustard is when it gets into a native plant area, it exudes a toxin from the roots that kills the mycorrhiza that allow the native plants to thrive in the woods. So that's a major problem. So if you can pull it up before it goes to seed, that's great. But yeah, harvest as much as possible. And I've seen fields of it, but it's all intact in its own area. You know, in the field is taken over by the garlic mustard and then surrounded by sidewalks and things like that. So, you know, there, you know, if it just keeps growing, it's just competing with itself. But anytime you see it near a native plant area, yeah, you want to get it out of there as soon as possible.
And now is the time to start cutting those off, because I've seen some in bloom already. So
yeah,
you want to get to it soon. We did have an email from Jackie in as regard to the fiddlehead ferns. Those probably are a little late now to find, I'm thinking.
It depends on what elevation you're at. You know, mm-hmm. the higher you go in elevation, the
yeah,
the
we're
latest.
Pretty flat around here. So
yeah, well, so certain ones, you know, it's been a long time. Like I grew up out east and knew ostrich fern, and then I came out west and, you know, learned the plants out here. Yeah, it should be pretty late. But if ostrich fern is like lady fern, right, the actual fiddleheads last a long time. So they come up, and all you see is fiddleheads in early spring mm-hmm. popping up out of the ground. There's no leaves because it's a, you know, a deciduous plant. And so when it grows full leaves, you can sort of pull the big leaves away and look towards the base at the center, and it'll often be creating new fiddleheads. And in fact, every time that the plant is chewed on by an animal or something, it stimulates new growth. So you actually have a season of maybe 2.5 months where you can gather fiddleheads. So it's not just a short.
Yeah, I did not realize that. So that's pretty cool. Excellent. I love it. Thanks for the email, Jackie. So before we get to another caller, let's talk about that Japanese knotweed, because, John, I've got so much of it. If you want it, you can come over and get it. But I was amazed by what you can do with it. Kind of go over that a little bit.
It's an amazing plant, and the foods that it produces are tremendous. In Asia where it originated, they don't worry about it like we do. You know, they let it grow, but they also know how to manage it, you know, because they're closer to the land than we are. The problem here is you get Japanese knotweed, and then nobody knows anything about plants anymore. And so they don't know what it is when it first starts up. Then it gets a foothold. Then it, you know, and then they're ignoring it because it's a hassle to deal with. And so then it gets out of hand, and then then you got a problem. So, but if you know all about it and you harvest it, it's perfectly manageable, right? So, and it doesn't spread well by seed. So it's not like it's carried off a lot and spread that way. It's mostly by rhizomes, you know, which are underground stems. It spreads that way. And so, you know, it gets a foothold, and then it starts spreading outward from there. It's an amazing food if you know what to do with it, which, again, I have a whole chapter on all the things that you can do with it.
I was amazed. It's like pretty much every part you can do something with, depending on how old it is and that type. Yeah, it's amazing. So even if it's just for that, you got to get the book, give it a try. Let's go to Julie in Fitchburg. Hi, Julie.
Hi, I just have a comment about foraging and jumping out of your car to pick something off the side of the road. I grew up out in the country here in Wisconsin, and I had strangers like in my yard. Somebody owns that land, so be careful if you're going to go foraging to make sure that you have permission if it's on private property or that you're doing it in public property, and that's okay to do. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thanks, Julie.
And that's a great point. You should be asking permission wherever you are. Now, some places are not maintained at all. And, you know, there's no way to ask whoever owns the property. And if I see an old field or something, I'm not going to go, you know, take over the land or anything like that. And I'm also going to go, you know, some distance from the road itself. You want to always be on the other side of a ditch. And it is interesting that back in history, it was a well-accepted common practice for people to allow people to go over their land. And now we're so tight and worried about things that property is now so sacrosanct that, you know, you can't step on my land or, you know, whatever. And I can appreciate that if people are worried about, you know, crooks and things like that. But this is such an innocent practice. But if I'm, you know, there'll be times where, you know, I'm walking down the sidewalk and there's, you know, a plum tree, and the plum tree is hanging over the sidewalk, the public sidewalk, and you can legally pick those, but I still ask permission because there's a house right there. And so, you know, I will always stop and ask permission no matter where I am. And if I am ever in a natural area, you always ask permission from whoever's managing that natural area. And if there's clearly a house somewhere, you know, attached to land, you always ask for permission.
Are there any other, like, rules or maybe legal things that peat foragers have to worry about?
Well, you know, mostly it's the property thing. Yeah.
Okay.
That. But the biggest thing is pollution. I mean, to me, that's the biggest worry that you should have about gathering wild foods. Because so much land has been taken over. I was just yesterday, I was just watching some guy, you know, he was, he had a business and he was out spraying, you know, to kill the weeds. And it would have been easier to grab each weed and pull it. It would have been easier, but no, he's sitting there, you know, standing up, spraying toxins all over the place, you know, and so I actually have a full chapter on how to avoid chemical spray.
That's right. It's very interesting also. We've got Kay in Madison who has a comment. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Great show. Thank you. I learned years ago from an office mate who got sold somebody's food package deal going on that most Americans only eat about 75 kinds of food. And my knowledge is that about the time of Christ, the Chinese had already documented about 3,000 kinds of food. I try to increase my food types just by buying different kinds of spices, as many as I can. But can you also confirm on the pollution deal that it's not good to take dandelion greens along a highway because the lead and stuff from the car exhaust gets on it?
Oh, yeah. There, you know, clearly traffic from, you know, since cars were invented, there was problems with depositing things by the roadside. I mean, you've got the rubber and petroleum products from the tires wearing off. You've got chemicals coming out of the vehicle, you know, dripping on the road. You know, you've got the exhaust and that had lead in it for a long time. And so, you know, the more trafficked an area is, the further you want to be away from the road. There's no getting away from it. I mean, you could be on an organic farm in the middle of nowhere and you still have planes dropping fuel from above and you've got, you know, pollution coming in from factories that are 100 miles away. And so, you know, there's no absolutely pure food source. You can just lower the amount that you take in by choosing wisely where you pick. And like I cover that in the chapter on contaminants.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question, Kay, and the comment. We're talking to John Kalis about his book, Wild Edible Plants. Now, we were talking about the different pollution sources and whatnot, but what about climate change? How will that affect foraging in the future?
Well, so right now we're noticing a lot of different climate changes. I mean, there's more hurricanes and, you know, tornadoes are more powerful. Right here in the Pacific Northwest, we just, you know, in the early spring, we had about 10 days of, you know, almost 100 degree weather. Oh, my God. You know, it's like when I first moved here, that would have been impossible. And now we're breaking records every day. And so and it's also affecting climatic patterns of moisture. So you're getting super dry spells for years and years and years, and then they're followed by these, rivers of moisture coming in. So you get, you know, the extremes happening over and over again, and a lot of the domesticated plants, they can't manage that. And so the nice thing about the genetics of the wild plants is that they're, particularly the edible weeds, are much more resistant to climatic changes and are good potential for future crops.
Okay. Thank you very much. There's one plant in here that you've got poison written all over. Yeah. Why did you decide to include that one?
Well, so you'll notice that's the only one I covered in there.
Yes.
And that's, you know, it's a look-alike to, well, look-alike is a term that mostly applies to novices. So everything is a look-alike to a novice. I mean, there's a lot of look-alikes. However, if you know a plant well, there's no look-alikes. You know the plant. You know those specific characteristics that you should be looking for. So I covered poison hemlock because it's very similar to wild carrot, and that is one of the major plants that people get poisoned by. So pokeweed is the champion. More people get poisoned by pokeweed, and I can go into the reasons why that happens, not because it's not edible, but because people don't know what they're doing. As soon as they know what they're doing, you don't get poisoned by pokeweed.
Oh, I did not realize that.
Yeah, yeah. But so I put hemlock in there because it's, well, pokeweed is in there too. It's under the edible plant section.
That's true. It is.
So, you know, I'm explaining you how to make it non-poisonous, and it's perfectly edible and delicious.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I did do poison hemlock because you can't make it edible, and it is confused a lot by novices. And so I want to really have that clear so no one can make a mistake, even at the youngest stage, because a lot of times people identify plants when they're in flower. You know, I can tell this flower is different from that flower. Well, that's not when people get poisoned. They get poisoned from poison hemlock when it's just coming out of the ground and it looks like a carrot top sticking out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You really need to know how to identify it at that stage. And so that's what I focus most of my attention for.
Well, we appreciate the book. It is a wonderful book. And I hope that people can buy a copy or check one out at your library because you'll really enjoy it. So thank you for being with us, John. And hopefully we'll see that volume 3.
Thank you, Jill. Yes, it'll be a while.
Okay.
3 to 6 years, I predict.
All right. Sounds good. Take care now. Yep. We've been talking with John Kalis. He's author of Edible Wild Plants, Wild Foods from Foraging to Feasting. He is owner, operator, and instructor at Wild Food Adventures Outdoor School. He also manages the Institute for the Study of Edible Wild Plants and Other Forageables. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We'll be back right after this to talk about plant diseases.